Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Sideshow Garden Podcast.
It's another Friday afternoon, and you are tuned to another episode of the Sideshow Garden Podcast at Sideshow on Twitter, facebook.com/thesideshow and sideshow.com. Before we get into this telephone call, just to let you know, Karen, who is the author of this wonderful book that I have in front of me, Gardening with Foliage First. Karen, let's just say it's about the third time for me to call Karen. That's not her fault. She didn't hang up on me. We didn't have an argument last night in a nightclub where I said, "You look extremely well," and she said, "No, I don't," and we fell out that way. It was more that there was a, I don't want to upset you listening to this whilst you're going to work on the train, and you think the guy beside you is maybe humming. Well, it's not him, but it may happen a little bit down the telephone line. So if it does in advance, I'm just letting you know. Is that okay? Hopefully that's okay. In the meantime, if you do enjoy what you hear, at Sideshow on Twitter, facebook.com/thesideshow and sideshow.com. And if you are feeling overly generous, you may go to your iTunes or Stitcher provider, podcast provider that is, and you can leave a rate and review there. Or as one person in the United States left as a comment, was it in the UK? They said, "I like the cut of your jib," which means they must have been listening, because that was a line that my mom used to use. Karen Chapman, you're very welcome to the Sideshow.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
It is indeed. I can hear you just about crystal clear as it stands at this moment in time. Anyway, Karen, I'm going to try and chat you up from afar at the bar, so to speak, for a
very far.
Yeah. Well, you know, long distance relationships in the olden days, I may have penned you a letter and strapped it to a pigeon, and hopefully you may have found out that I fell in love with you. Karen, what is your background before we get into a little bit about the book? Where do you start? Where do you live? What do you do for a living?
I grew up in England, so I know my accent is sounding a bit of a mongrel. To American ears, I sound British. Probably to you, I still sound somewhat Americanized. I don't know. But yeah, I was born and bred on the Wirral Peninsula, did a degree at Warwick University, lived in the Peak District until 1996. And then my husband and I and our two then small children moved to Seattle. So that's where I am right now. And as the children grew up, I retrained, new career as a landscape designer and a garden writer.
The book, Karen, and I normally don't get into, I guess, the subject of the show, I'm told, until a little bit later, maybe in the interview. But most of the garden books that I would have on my shelf, if I take Zenaida Zengo, who I interviewed live in Salt Lake City, Utah, some weeks ago, her book on air plants, also published by your own publisher, Timber Press. Zenaida's book was very much a little bit, how do I call it? It was air plants. There was very beautiful photography. She, I guess, penned the book, if I might isolate those two parts to it. You have co-written this with a lady, Christina Solowitz. How did that relationship work? Who wrote what, and who did what roles, I guess?
It was very much a collaboration. The beauty of having a co-author is that we can divide and conquer. And America's a big country. We wanted to try and include combinations and ideas for people right across the country. So while she'd be hiking it off to Florida to photograph gardens and do the write-ups from that photography, I might be, say, in British Columbia doing some work up there. And the other neat part about it was, as we came to write these up, you know, often we just have a complete brain freeze. You know, you'd have the photographs, you'd have the basic vital statistics of the plants, and you didn't have a creative bone left. Well, then the other one could pick that piece up. And we flip-flop in that way. So every single combination in the book has both our fingerprints on it.
But here's the thing, and let's get into this then, because on my bookshelf I have, let's say, for example, Royal Horticultural Society A to Z Encyclopedia of Garden Plants, and it's kind of done like a directory on that part. It, on the other hand, I guess the usual stereotypical thing that one might be aware of, or listeners to the Sideshow may be aware of, is that there are let's say, books that are written usually about garden design, and they have included 50 variations of or 100 variations of styles and themes, and they're broken down into those various categories, all seem to have a floral, an attractive, the bits that we love about the garden, be it the daffodils that are out of flower or the tulips that are out of flower. It has always been that attraction to what I guess is more colourful. Yours is on the foliage, and it jumped off the page for me because it didn't note the thing that we are usually most attracted to. Is that a fair way to put that? And why did that, I guess, appeal to you a little bit more?
From personal experience of gardening as well as designing gardens for others, I think what we tend to do, we're very colour driven, as you say, and most of us, when we'll go into a garden centre or nursery, we'll immediately just gravitate to whatever is in bloom. It might be that stand of gorgeous delphiniums or the latest echinacea, but we're right over there and grabbing one of each, putting them in the cart, taking them home, and they look great for 3 weeks. But somehow by the middle of the summer, our gardens can look completely devoid of interest because we've been so focused on the flowers. We haven't noticed that all the leaves of these beautiful blooming plants are just mid-green, mid-sized, and really have nothing of interest at all. So what Christina and I do as designers, and what we have shown in the book, is that if you initially build that picture frame, if you will, of interesting foliage, different colored foliage, different textures, and then layer into that flowers or maybe a container, bark, berries, the finishing touch. If you layer it into that picture frame of foliage, you're going to have a much more pleasing final result and a garden which has a much longer period of interest.
We've got two, I guess, if we take the show garden example, if I'm allowed to do that, there are generally speaking two colours that I will notice without question across the planet. And one is Buxus sempervirens, the box hedging, number one. And it works well in show gardens for very simple logic reasons. Number two, we have the Betula pendula, usually Jacimontii, which is the white-stemmed birch. You've obviously gone way far away from all of them. What are the ones that you tend to notice maybe in show gardens where you, how do I say it, where you might frown? Are you along the lines of the box and the birch, and or do you see it slightly differently and turn around and go, well, they should have or could have used maybe that or that?
No, I think that's a starting point, but it's very limiting. So, you know, I actually have seven of those Betula in my own garden. I've got 5 acres here and I love them for the white bark. But just taking that for a second, what I might do is layer in front of that something which has a variegated white and green foliage. And it might be one of the veronicas if I wanted to put a perennial that way, so that there's a color echo between the bark and the leaf. And then I have the bonus of the veronica blooms later on as well. So that's how I use elements like that. Boxwood is great, but it's just plain solid green. I mean, I love to explore, for example, on the deciduous shrubs, I'd be thinking of things like the spirea, many of which open with an orange tone. In the magic carpet is a dwarf variety. It opens orange and it goes into more of a golden tone for midsummer. Fall color includes some purple in there. I mean, it's remarkable. And on top of all that, it has bright pink flowers. So those are the kind of foliage additions I love to insert into a garden, as well as things like the boxwood. Or I might use Osmanthus delaveii, not so much in a show garden, but in a real garden, where I then have the looser form. I still have that small glossy leaf, but I have the spring flowers as well.
I gather what you're not saying, Karen, is that the objective of the book is to garden. And bearing in mind, for those of you listening at home, just to remind you, the title of the book is Gardening with Foliage, published by Timber Press, if you want to go take a look at it. And I'll have a link up on sideshow.com or just at Sideshow on Twitter, and I'll drop you on a note on it. The objective of the book, though, Karen, is not to solely garden with foliage. It is more that when the flower is gone or when that leaf is gone from, let's say, the tree, that the bark and the foliage therefore still creates or gives the effect of a garden. Is that a better way to put that?
Absolutely. So you've got your foliage framework, and you know, which are going to be the leaves, and then the finishing touch, which might be the flower or the berries or whatever that particular element is. I mean, to give you an example, there's a fun combination in the book called Sassitude, which I actually photographed in my own garden. And it's what we call Crayola colours, you know, which is a branded crayons. I think they still have those over your side of the pond as well.
They do, yes. Indeed.
Okay, so kind of Crayola colours, red, yellow and blue. So I've got a dwarf bright red barberry in there, a blue star juniper, and then a golden spirea. What I did for the floral element was add in the aculeo, the yarrow, the variety called paprika, which opens again in these crimson tones and has the stamens, which are that little fuzzy yellow bit in the middle. So you've got that color echo between the barberry, the spirea, and the yarrow. Everything ties in together. The blue star juniper just tones it down a little, but also speaks to the foliage of the yarrow. And then when the yarrow is not blooming, you still have that entire color scheme going on, thanks to the foliage framework.
The book itself, you do tend to do that point between what is reference and what makes me leaf through it. And, you know, I always use the analogy of falling in love. Well, I tend to seem to always use it. And again, chatting you up at the, well, from afar rather than at a bar, but... Pardon me. In context, and I'll reference the Zenaida Zengo interview again on this one where I was turned down, and there's another couple of, I'm always turned down. I'm the most misfortunate man that has ever existed when it comes to that department. But, you know, when you pick a book up in a shop, when you see it, I won't say maybe online, but in person, there's two things that always strike me. Number one, it's the presentation. It's how it feels and how it looks. And again, it is that analogy of, am I wooed to it? Will I want to leaf through? Timber Press have done a really fine job of piecing it together, as have yourself and Christina. But you're at the junction between, again, that reference book and what is, I guess, broken up into colour coding by looking at the leaves of the frills of the book as you leaf through it, if you understand me, for those of you listening at home. And then it's broken almost up into categories again. Why did you do it that way, or what was the thinking behind that part?
Well, I think as gardeners, there are several things, as you say, we look for in a book. There's that initial visual pull. So the photography has to be up to par, and the pictures have to be big enough to draw you in. So our beauty shots are almost full page size. But we also wanted folks to be able to problem solve. And so, as you say, it's very clearly divided by colour, and that colour is on the edge of the page, into spring and summer combinations, which are done in green, and fall and winter combinations, which are colour-coded in the orange. And then each of those, again, have a light shade and a dark shade, referencing sun or shade combinations. So if you just need a fast answer for what can you do differently in that shade area and you want something for summer, you can go straight to that part of the book. So we wanted to do that reference element, but then also to make it so that gardeners of any level could really get something from this. So we have our little explanation of the design written underneath that main beauty shop photograph there, really describing how the pieces of that combination work together. And then on the next section, we're talking about how the design evolves over time. So perhaps a little bit of maintenance that might need it, what might need dividing, what one might add, perhaps ephemeral spring bulb to extend the interest in the early season. Before going into discussing each of those individual plants, which you saw in the main photograph. So all the information is there, but we try and give that inspiration. And, you know, new gardeners are just going to want to take this and copy the idea. Whereas experienced gardeners like yourself might simply use it as a springboard. So I like that combination, but I've got such and such, which would be a great substitute for that one. Let me see what I can do with that. So we hope we reach a number of different people, even designers, when you just need some fresh ideas as to what to do. We've been getting great feedback from colleagues on that level as well.
For those of you listening at home, I should add, not to cut across Karen in any way whatsoever, but you got what I'm saying on the phone line bit. It's all right, and your ear is adapted to it, and you're doing good. However, it's not, let's say, to usual standard. Again, that's, I would still kind of be inclined to ask Karen out for a drink, if that makes sense to you. We're the imaginary love affair is going according to plan. We're never going to get there, but it's going according to plan. We're okay. Yeah, in Peter's head. More back to the book, Karen. You have, and let me just stick on one chapter. You have combinations for fall and winter, and in that department, I would refer, or it would stand out to me, that it's kind of written with the American US kind of line in place, or autumn as we would know it, maybe better in UK and Ireland. When you transfer this book to, let's say, Dublin or London, how do these combinations work over this side of the woods, a geography that you would also know as well as you would know the States?
Well, thankfully, I'm in the perfect position to answer that, having lived in both places. And in fact, the area where we live, in the Seattle area, is a very, very similar climate to most of London, the UK, in fact. Once you get down towards Devon and Cornwall, it's a little bit warmer there than we are in Seattle. But for the most part, there's an absolute correlation between the two. So you're going to find that the way we have set this out, our seasons in the book are going to relate perfectly for those of you on the other side of the Atlantic. Bearing in mind that our book does include some photographs, for example, from Arizona and from Southern California, those are not going to be ones that the typical gardener over there is going to be able to copy. But I don't know, I think I'm the same as you in that I love to challenge myself sometimes. And so just because in theory I can't possibly grow that purple prickly pear doesn't mean I'm not going to try and include it one year, even just as an annual. And so, you know, it's fun just to have some new ideas, even if they're not long term. There's something in there, I think, for everyone, for the hardcore gardener, as well as for those that maybe want to experiment with something a little bit different.
And in that department, there is one interview that I will reference for you listening at home. It's a couple of weeks ago now, so you'll have to scroll back through iTunes. And it was the interview with St. Patrick's Boys National School based in Cork. They have a school garden, but it's not just any old school garden. In there they grow rice and tea. They are trialing bananas and I believe pineapples, and that's the level that they were at. And also on the other side, my grandmother grew in a courtyard surrounded on four sides on the south side of Dublin. She would have grown a lemon from a pip. And sometimes these things just work. And yeah, you have to stretch yourself. And yes, there are things that are a little bit more, how do you say, frost prone, like the banana plants or whatever the case may be. You do have to kind of go and trial those things. Well, I was always that inquisitive brain anyway. When people said you can't grow that here, my head always said, well, I'm gonna damn sure try. And
I've got a lot of Irish blood in me and I say exactly the same thing.
But you horticulturally, Karen, you do have to challenge, because there's only one way to figure out for yourself why you can't grow it over here. And as I would note over and over again, as I noted to Ian Price's doing Chelsea this year, you know, if you don't fail miserably on your own, by your own way of doing things, you'll never really fully understand. You'll only ever have been told. Have you gone to that level? Have you done those extremes yourself?
I'd like to say I'm really tenacious. My husband called me downright stubborn and does frequently refer back to my Irish heritage for that. I think it's a very healthy trait to have, really. But, you know, I think it's important, as you say, we do test things. For example, the sweet potato vines, Ipomaea, however you pronounce that thing, but those sweet potato vines, when they first came out onto the market, they were actually hailed as being a plant for the sun and the sun only. So, of course, I immediately planted them in the shade, where in fact they did just as well, if not better, than in the sun. You know, we only discover these things if we try. Banana plants that you mentioned, for those people that have got more patience than me, they can be overwintered. There are several ways of doing that. So, you know, life's short. I think we have to take a moment, enjoy it, and explore those plants out there.
Yes, well, let's go and stick with the Irish connection. I don't often get to do it, ladies and gentlemen, for you listening at home. I don't often get to do it. I definitely don't, unless I'm in Salt Lake City and it's St. Patrick's Day. And that's an entirely different story, and we leave that one there. But just for the minute, on page 280, you have a chapter which is noted as the Emerald Isle. The underneath part of it, and there's a mild jest in here, and then there's also the serious side of it. So for those of you who know the book, you'll know exactly where I am. Turn to page 280. For those of you who don't, this is where it starts to get a little bit different. Emerald Isle, site, full sun, not Irish. Soil, average, you're kind of heading towards Irish. Zone 7 to 9, we'll forget that bit for a minute, and season year round. When you note the Emerald Isle, the plants that you have in it are, let me give you Golden Japanese Cedar, Cryptomeria Japonica, don't get confused by that, Weeping Brown Sedge, which is Carex, my apologies, and the finishing touch is Victoria Californian Lilac, or these Ceanotus, my apologies, Teresa Flora Victoria, I just about got that one out. It's not Emerald Isle true and true. It's more a title that you have given to a combination. Have I got that bit right?
That's right. And this one is one of Christina's, who has no Irish blood in her whatsoever. So, yeah, she was really going off the shade of emerald green and that bright, vivid green, which one thinks of as the shamrock colour. And that was how she put the spin on it for the Emerald Isle. So, yeah, she wasn't trying to suggest that this was a photograph either from Ireland or specifically Irish-like. It was more a spin on the particular bright shade of green that's in there.
But again, and it was the jest in there of that, and it's now being clarified. But on the other hand, to the horticultural side, for those of you who are unaware of the book, it kind of gives you an idea, because even if I go to just the next page, I have a pumpkin spice latte.
And that's one of mine. I was hungry that day.
but in that, and again, like, I have to credit you. I mean, this is an arrangement not in a garden. It's an arrangement in a pot, and stereotypically in container gardening, in, let's call it, state made or collated arrangements of plants, which is essentially what our gardens are, either be they in containers or be they not. And usually they look great when we have them in the summertime, and then they kind of go little bit, we put them around the back of the shed, and then we pull out maybe the headers that were never watered for 3 or 4 months, for example sake. And I'm just taking the mick here slightly, not out of you at home and not out of Karen, but I'm not far off the mark, Karen. And again, when I look at the list of plants that you tend to have here, that combination, you have the Penicetum or the Jester Ornamental Millet, you have the Little Flames, the Lusoto, I call it.
We pronounce it Lucothaway, but you know, I would say if I pronounce anything with a British accent, as long as I'm in America, people are going to believe me. So we'll just go with that. We'll call it Lucothaway.
Okay, we'll go with that. We have Oncinia and we have the Heuchera. And again, it seems to be, it's the pumpkin spice latte. You have the little bit of orange, you have the little bit of dark browns, and it tends to kind of go on that way. Have you, in all of this, Karen, have you, between the two of you, have you gone and arranged all of these things in your gardens, in your spaces, in your space outdoors, and then went, actually, no, that kind of looks terrible, let's rearrange this again, let's take one out, let's put one in? And you're almost at the point where, when I talk to my good friend Katrina Redmond, who has written the book Wholesome, a cooking book, let me just give you a different variation or spin a different direction. When I speak to her, she kind of says to me, no, you have to test the recipes to an extent, and then you turn around and go, well, visually it looks good, okay, and then it tastes good, and then the recipe works out. So what you're actually writing down, it works for that person at home repeatedly over and over and over again. Did you have to do that to an extent? Because on one hand you've got like newly planted containers and gardens, and then on the other hand you've got obviously the when they mature and how they all evolve. And I understand you've got like a horticultural education in there, as would I, so I can picture those arrangements of plants in my head. But was there an element of testing those to see did they work?
So, you know, a small amount. So we do this all the time. You know, I think we probably both describe ourselves as full-time designers and three-quarter-time writers. And so when you're designing all the time, you get so much of it becomes intuitive. As an example, just this pumpkin spice latte that you are referencing is a combination which is all foliage, and the finishing touch is a little orange pumpkin tucked in there, and there's some ornamental chili peppers, which are just fun elements. I actually found at the grocery store and took those in. So there's no actual flowers in there. But what I did, and it's something that your listeners would be able to see, is how I made sure that the colors move around the entire container. And that's one of the key tricks, whether it's a landscape design or a container design, is in this particular example, there are three dark leaves. They're all different shaped leaves, but there's three dark leaves. And I made sure they're at three different points around an imaginary circle. They're not all clumped on one side. Likewise, the lighter tones are spread around. And that's, you know, again, it's looking for that color connection. It's moving things within a space. So sometimes you might go to put a container together and, you know, you know something's not quite right. And simply by moving one plant a few inches to the left, then that's going to solve the problem. Actually, this particular one, it was interesting, the pumpkin spice latte, this one was redone. I'd forgotten until you just mentioned it now. I originally planted it in a green container and I photographed it and I didn't like it. And I ran to my local store and picked up this deep chocolate brown container, replanted the whole thing in that, and suddenly it made sense. And, you know, that again is a great design lesson for everyone, is that the container is a part of the design. It's not just an empty vessel into which to put the plants. It plays an important role. And so the color of the container and that glossiness was actually, again, speaking to the plant elements within it. So I did have to redo the container itself in that one. You caught me.
Well, apologies, but I'm also secretly delighted that I vindicated the question that I originally asked. Karen, let me go to just one point inside the book which caught my eye. And it is a wee little quote inside couple of pages. And it says, quote, "To our gardening friends, past, present and future, whose passion for plants, the landscape, good wine and chocolate sustains us, Karen and Christina." Mom used to have a wee little sign sticking inside the front door as we walked into her house saying, "Life is too short for cheap wine." And this is probably the closest that I've got to that, where there seems to be a little bit of a balance, can I call it that, between what is one love and, if I can put chocolate and wine into that category as well, what is another love. What was the reason behind that quote?
We went through a lot of wine and chocolate writing the book. You know, we'd have some really late nights and we'd be backwards and forwards on the phone and on the email trying to wrap stuff up, or we'd be meeting deadlines, or our husbands would be coming in and just simply put chocolate in front of us because they knew we needed something. So yeah, we seriously kept the industry going in wine and chocolate while this book was being written. And of course it's also fun, you know, some of these gardens were in friends' properties over some other state somewhere, and invariably the shoot would end as the light was going down in the evening, and so what better way to finish the day with a glass of wine with the homeowner who'd been gracious enough to allow us to crawl around on our hands and knees to get the perfect shot for the previous few hours. So yes, we did keep the chocolate and wine industry in business there.
That's a lovely way to put it. Karen Chapman and Christina Salwitz are the authors of Gardening with Foliage. First, 127 dazzling combinations that pair the beauty of leaves with flowers, bark, berries and more. It is available via Timber Press. If you're stuck and you're on the road, don't worry about any of that. At Sodshow on Twitter, facebook.com/thesodshow and sodshow.com, or just stick into a Google search, Karen Chapman and Sodshow, S-O-D-S-H-O-W. My thanks to Becky and Bessie in the Timber Press offices for putting this interview together. And my thanks to you for listening, and apologies if you've heard one of those two, what do I call them, ferrets, gerbils, rabbits, or sometimes snow and rain coming a little bit down the telephone line. I think it's fair to suggest that it has been worthwhile a listen. Karen, if people want to get in touch with you, do you have a website? Are you on the Twitter? Are you on the Facebook thing?
I'm on Facebook, and in fact, if you head over to findfoliage.com on the Facebook, if you look for that, you'll find both Christina and I. We manage a Facebook page there and we post great pictures and our event listings, and you can also find us personally on Facebook as well.
Excellent. Karen Chapman, thank you so much for your time. It has been a real genuine pleasure, and thanks for taking the time to talk to me this week.
My pleasure. Thanks, Peter. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Will do, Karen. Take care. Have a good one. Slán.
Bye-bye.
And that is all we have time for this episode of The Sodshow. If there's anything you need, anything at all, again, at Sodshow on Twitter, facebook.com/thesodshow and sodshow.com. If you are listening to this and you enjoyed what you heard, press that middle button on your phone. Leave a rate and review on iTunes if you really feel like the need. And if you're like my good friend James Robbins, what you will do is actually send me a note on Twitter saying that life has been pretty good to date, apart from listening to The Sodshow. He tends to insult me It's an in-joke between me and you, but he tends to insult me nonetheless on a weekly basis at this stage of the game. And James, I have to say, it brings a smile to my face. Thank you so much. As by the way, I should add, James is our only supporter on patreon.com, and again, you'll find that through sideshow.com. Thanks very much, James. That's all we have time for. We'll chat to you next week, same place, same time. Take care. God bless. Safe home. Bye-bye.